You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special three-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prop G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is Good One, a podcast about jokes. I'm your host, Vulture Senior Editor, Jesse David Fox. Each episode, I have a comedian come on to play a clip of one of their bits and discuss how they wrote it and how it fits to what they're trying to do with their comedy. This week, our guest is Taylor Tomlinson, a rising comedian who just released her first Netflix Hour special, Quarter Life Crisis, at an age so young it must be uttered in hushed tones. 26! Sorry, 26. It really is incredibly rare for a comedian to get to this level so young. As a result, we tend to know the names of wunderkinds, be it Pete Davidson, Bo Burnham, Eddie Murphy. So, how did Taylor get here? Growing up super religious in California, the eldest of four daughters, Taylor started in comedy while in high school, when her father had the idea of taking a stand-up class together at a local church. She jokes that he probably thought she'd be able to write material for him. However, it was Taylor who had a knack for being on stage. She was so good, she was soon touring the Christian comedy circuit, which is a real thing, where she had to perform an act so clean it would make Ned Flanders look like Bart Frinkin' Simpson. Again, at this point, she is still in high school. She started college, but dropped out fairly quickly as she was starting to get work performing at colleges. Just when she thought she was out of churches, they pulled her back in. At 21, she was a finalist on NBC's Last Comic Standing, where the show's producer, somewhat against her will, positioned her as a church comedian. This resulted in a new slew of church gigs until she couldn't take it anymore. She became a regular old touring secular club comedian, headlining major clubs and soon playing theaters in some markets. In 2017, she performed on Conan for the first time, becoming one of the comedians Conan has since fully embraced, having her join him on live dates. In 2018, she chose to do a 15-minute set on Netflix's comedy lineup instead of a Comedy Central half hour. It went so well that when Taylor sent Netflix a tape trying to get a 30-minute special on the streamer, they offered her a full hour. I can see why. There's an undeniable quality to Taylor, who tells jokes with clear, hard punchlines. The joke we talk about from her Netflix hour showcases her journey and growth as she tells the story of finally trying to lose her virginity. I say trying as she does not succeed. Now, here is Taylor Tomlinson.
First time I tried to lose my virginity, I missed. That happened to anybody else in here? Not physically, I wasn't stupid. It wasn't like, oh, I was like trying to put a straw on a Capri Sun. It wasn't like that. What happened was, I was waiting until marriage or until Jesus came back, because I'm like, my dad will like him, right? And I waited, and then finally, I tried to lose it to my boyfriend in college, who said, no, thank you, which was a bit of a curveball. Nobody told me to expect sexual rejection as a woman. Nobody prepares you. From the time you start walking as a little girl, they're like, hey, everybody wants in there. You got to build a perimeter and keep everyone out. I was so busy trying to keep people out of me, I never thought I'd have to talk someone into me. Men take sexual rejection much easier because they're prepared for it. From the time they start walking, they're like, hey, Brent, you're a little creepy. Maybe keep an eye on that. You're going to need to get consent, which is a noise she makes, not a feeling you feel. But because men are prepared for it, they bounce back real quick. They walk around like vacuum salesmen, just like, eh, eh, there's another house over here. My boyfriend was nervous to have sex with a virgin, and I was like, well, the good news is you only have to do it once, and then guess what? Problem solved. I felt like a high schooler trying to get a job at the Gap, just like,
oh, well, we really want someone with retail experience. It's like, well, how am I supposed to get some unless someone takes a chance on me?
I was literally told by somebody that getting rid of my virginity as a woman was going to be like handing out free samples at a Costco. And instead, I felt like one of those guys on the Vegas Strip trying to hand you a nightclub flyer. And it's like, no, come on in. It'll be fun. There's lights. It's kind of damp. Get in here. It's fun. But you know what they say? Women always go for men like their fathers. So I keep going for guys who do not want to sleep with me. Like, that is... so like my dad, all right? No reason to be offended. That joke's about what a great dad my dad is. I lost my virginity late. I lost it when I was financially independent. Yeah, I went through my bank statements. Like, I could afford to have a dick in me. Just, like, so responsible. All my other friends lost it under a Backstreet Boys poster in their mom's house, and I lost it under an IKEA painting that I purchased with a coupon. But I'm glad I was raised that way because it taught me how to choose sexual partners in a very responsible way, okay? Because when I was younger and I was waiting, I would tell guys, I'm not ready to have sex yet. Is that okay? And anytime guys are really cool about that decision, that just made me want to have sex with them more because there is nothing hotter than someone respecting your boundaries. You're just like, what? Take your pants off. Get over here. The hottest thing you can say to a girl is, hey, we don't have to do anything. Now we do. So I still do this as a sexually active adult. I pretend I'm not ready to have sex with someone new yet, just to make sure they're a good person first. I call it the gobstopper test. I go, oh, I'm not ready, is that okay? He's like, totally fine, no worries at all. And I'm like, Charlie, you won! You did it! I knew you could, my boy! Now come inside my chocolate factory! It's all for you!
I am here with Taylor Tomlinson. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Big fan.
Oh, thank you so much. Feelings Mutual, the special is very good.
Thank you.
I'm excited to talk about it. So before we get to the joke that is the subject of the episode, so this special comes out around 10 years into you doing stand-up. The joke we're going to talk about is not one you could have told for a variety of reasons when you started. So I wanted to set up with your journey about how you're able to get to the point where you're going to tell this joke. So at age 16, you took a stand-up comedy class with your dad, and it was taught by a Christian comedian. Mm-hmm. From there, you became a touring Christian comedian. The result is, for years, in particular your formative years, your relationship to stand-up was intertwined with your relationship with your father and the church. I want to talk to you about the steps and the jokes that allowed you to sort of detangle that a bit.
Oh, gosh, yeah. What a great question.
The question even... So let's
like, well, even ask the question yet.
So early on, can you think of a joke or jokes that you told that eventually that church bookers pushed back on?
Yes, I remember the joke that made me quit doing churches. So I was performing in clubs and occasionally churches as well up until I was like 22. Mm-hmm. So like 4 years ago now, and which is fairly recently. And then once I got to that point, I was kind of trying to phase out of it. I had done Last Comic Standing like right after I turned 21, and they had really wanted to present this narrative of like, look, you're a church comedian. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. The only one on the show. And I was like, I perform at more colleges than I do in churches, and I don't really want to be considered a church comedian. And they were like, totally, totally. We'll never do that. And then, of course, that's what goes on reality television.
Sure.
Because that's the most interesting angle because they hadn't had that before. But when I was 22, I had been opening for a very big church comedian. His road manager called me and was like, hey, so you tweeted something and it's funny. It's just like we have kids in our audience and, you know, we all think you're great, but it's just, it's a different thing and we just need to be careful and, you know, protect our guy and all that. And I was like, yeah, I totally understand. And of course, felt shame in that I've never been fired from anything. Mm-hmm. So as like a good kid, you're like, oh my God. But as soon as that happened, the joke ended up on my first late night set on Conan a few years ago, which was, I'm a wild animal in bed, way more afraid of you than you are of me. And that was enough to get me fired mm-hmm. from, you know, a string of church dates. And I just remember thinking, I don't ever want to feel this way again. I don't ever want to feel like I'm walking on eggshells or like I've disappointed somebody or like I lied to somebody or, mm-hmm. or misled them. Not even that they made me feel that way when they let me go or took me off those tour dates. It was just some internal stuff, probably from growing up so religious. And I mean, even now, if I do a show where some of my jokes are too off color or dirty or whatever for maybe an audience that's a little older or a little more conservative, depending on where I'm at in the country, it really taps into that for mm-hmm. me. And I still feel that like dormant guilt and shame a little bit. And then I just get upset that I still feel that way. So that was a huge turning point for me. And that was the point that I told, you know, my managers and agents, like, hey, I know you're going to get offers for me to do churches. I know it's good money. Just don't send them to me. I don't care how much it is. Like, just don't send them to me. I can't do it. I'm not what they want. Because if you do churches, you got to be that all the time. Yeah. You have to be squeaky clean in clubs. In like, if you're going to do both, you have to,
you have
be,
to be squeaky
that
clean in your private life.
You do.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know people who perform in churches that are like, ooh, we can't post pictures of us drinking. Like, you mm-hmm. get, you have to be so, so careful and like that with like worrying about getting canceled now. It's like, yeah. How many ways can you lose your career, honestly?
So then, so you mentioned the 2017, the first Conan set. Mm-hmm. You talk about your dad a little bit in that. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the reaction he had to certain jokes?
You know, I ran it by him before I did the set, and he was like, yep, that's how I feel about things. I'm good with it. And then
specifically the gay marriage.
The gay marriage, yes. Because my parents are more conservative, and I had a joke about his beliefs on that. And after it came out, he was very proud for a couple of days, and then it upset him. Mm-hmm. Which I can understand. It is different, like seeing something on TV, I suppose. And I have a lot of jokes about him in the new special that I also ran past him before I filmed it. And I tried to be really careful in the special about cushioning those jokes with like, my dad's great yeah. and I love him and he made me who I am, because I think everybody has those stories about their parents that everyone goes, ooh, yikes, or like things they said to you or beliefs they have that you don't agree with or aren't, you know, quite up to speed with mm-hmm. today's wokeness. And
sure. And
it doesn't mean that you're like, my parents are bad people. You're just poking fun at it. It's tough because I do try to be careful with that kind of stuff. I'm more careful now than maybe I used to be. But I also feel like it really depends on what it is. So like, for example, there was a joke that I had in my hour about my grandma that I ran past her before I filmed the special. She thought it was funny. And then a few days later, she was like, actually, could you not? And I was like, it's gone.
Yeah.
Cut. Totally. It's not worth it. But that was like a personal story about herself that she told me that I was making a joke about. Whereas everything that I say about my parents, it's things that they said to me or things that directly affected me, or I'm saying something positive about them mm-hmm. usually.
And then, so what about jokes that they don't approve of that aren't about you? In your 2018, the comedy lineup 15 minutes you did, I believe you said your parents stopped talking to you for a week, or they didn't talk to you for a week.
It's just they went real quiet for about a week because they had come to New York to see me on The Tonight Show the week before that came out. And that was like, you know, The Tonight Show is super clean. It's great. They love it. Jimmy Fallon was there. But then The 15 came out and I thought they had watched it, but they didn't say anything about it. And then I just didn't hear from them for like a week. And I called them like a week later and was like, hey, did you see it? And they were like, yep, we saw it. And I was like, okay. Which, again, I totally get. Like, I'm not really their cup of tea anymore. Like, it stinks because I know they think it's cool what I'm doing. And I'm sure they are proud. But they also have their own morals and beliefs. And there are... They don't want to watch anyone tell sex jokes, let alone their daughter. You know what I mean? Like, I get it.
I heard you say they felt as well. You were pandering, or by cursing, you were.
I was trying to be part of the club. That was kind of the thing. Yeah, they made a comment like that of like, it just seems like, because they had just seen me do this squeaky clean set. So in their mind, and they hadn't seen me do stand up live for years.
Yeah,
they had, the last time they'd seen me, I was opening for Brian Regan, you know, when I was like 21. So they hadn't seen me in a few years. And I had kind of told them like, okay, just so you know, like I curse now and I'm not totally clean anymore. And the Comedy Lineup set isn't even really that bad. I mean, I swear maybe twice, but I do have some
innuendo. You have a joke about condoms.
I have a condom
joke.
Probably
beyond what he wanted.
Didn't love it. And I get it. I mean, this special, I was like, you guys do not need to watch it. I don't know if they're going to, but I straight up just said like, you're not going to like it. It's okay. It doesn't hurt my feelings. You know, if it weren't me, I wouldn't go, you'd really love this gal, you know, like it's fine. I told them I'm doing The Tonight Show tomorrow, so you guys can watch that. Like, that was kind of the thing. But it's funny because like my grandparents watched The 15 and they loved it. And I don't know if there's enough separation.
They're
like, you're far enough away that we
it doesn't
have
implicate
some
them in the same way.
Yeah, it doesn't implicate them in the same way. But I think I'm a pretty responsible person.
Yeah, comparatively.
Yeah, I would like that's comedians. The thing. You're like, I said I use condoms. Like, that's pretty good. I and I do all these jokes in this one about being abstinent for a long time and like not sleeping with a lot of people and just like I'm like, oh, I'm right there though. Like there's still part of you that wants your parents to go, you're pretty good. Like you got close, which is so silly.
Since I know you're a fan of The Artist's Way, Julia Cameron's seminal book from the early 90s, which gave people tips and techniques to help gain confidence in pursuing creative endeavors. I was asked to summarize the book. And now my producer is mad that I then said this. It's just so funny to read a direct quote. Anyway, so I was thinking about a quote about not calling the inability to start laziness, but calling it fear. And so Cameron writes, most frequently it's a fear of abandonment. This fear has roots in childhood reality. Most blocked artists try to become artists against either their parents' good wishes or their parents' good judgment. For a youngster, that is quite a conflict. To go squarely against your parents' values means you better know what you're doing. You better not just be an artist. You better be a great artist if you're going to hurt your parents so much. So
I just start dry heaving.
What do you think about the quote? By the time you're working on the material that is this special, where have you settled on the idea of your relationship to your stand-up as it relates to the church and your family?
I mean, I love that Julia Cameron quote. I think it's so perfect. I remember reading that, if you're going to disappoint your parents so much, you'd better be a great artist. I feel that way every day. I was talking to someone about it last night where I was like, it's crazy that it still makes me sad that they probably won't like it and that they'll be disappointed because, of course, I never want to hurt them or upset them in any way. But you also can't really be anything other than what you are. And I think I tried to be that for a long time. I think I tried to be a clean Christian comedian for a few years longer than maybe I wanted to. And at a certain point, I just thought there's so many things I want to talk about and want to make jokes about that I can't in this space. And also, when I started doing stand-up, I mean, I hadn't even been to prom, let alone, like, had sex. Like, I hadn't done anything. I think I'd kissed one person when I was 16. Maybe that's not true. But, like, I had barely dated at all. So, of course, it was easier to be clean.
Yeah.
And then once you start having more relationships and dating experience and sex and whatnot, and of course you want to talk about all those things, and there's a reason people tell jokes about relationships and dating, because it's the most relatable thing to talk about. It's the thing we all have in common.
You can't tell jokes about being abstinent when you are a person who's dating and is not abstinent.
Yeah. By the way, there were churches that would not let me tell jokes about being abstinent. I'm like, I'm promoting the thing you like, but they wouldn't want you to even refer to anything like that. Like, if you're married and you have a family and stuff, you can sometimes get away with a little innuendo in the church, because everyone's like, he's a good guy, he's got a wife and four kids and whatever. But as like a single female who was 19, nobody's going to be on board with that. They're going to go, you're leading people astray. I told a joke once where I think I said stripper in it, and it wasn't like a dirty joke. And I remember somebody in the church was like, every time you say that, you are making men think of strippers, and this is your fault, and you're compromising their salvation. And I was like, this is, come on, guys. I'm sure they're all thinking about it anyway. But yeah, in doing this special, I definitely knew that it was going to be a little bit of a turning point, because everybody has Netflix. And there are things that I've said on stage that friends of mine have told me, like, that doesn't really sound like your voice. That's a little dirtier than I think your voice is. And it doesn't fit in with the rest of your material. And those notes are always really helpful, because I do think you can misrepresent yourself on stage sometimes. But I felt like the hour that finally came together for Quarter Life Crisis was totally representative of me and where I'm at. And I wouldn't say that I'm religious anymore. You know, I'm 26, so who knows who I'm going to be in 4 years, to be honest with you. But I wasn't putting it out like, ooh, I'll never work a church again. Yeah. Like, that ship sailed a while ago. But a huge source of stress for me was upsetting my parents or upsetting my extended family, because, you know, they're all conservative and like, and they're pretty cool. I'm going to be honest. Like, they're really cool. They're not like stuffy. I think they get it. It was mostly just my parents, to be honest. I mean, even my extended family that's more conservative is pretty open-minded, I think.
So let's talk about the joke that brought you here today. So in general, how do you write? What does writing material look like for you?
Well, when you first start out, it's kind of just whenever jokes come to you, because you can write about anything and you don't have any material yet. And now that it's my full-time job, over the years, it has really become like I get up in the morning and make tea and sit down at a desk. Like, I have an office at home, or I go to a coffee shop if I'm on the road. I have trouble writing in hotel rooms for some reason, by like some light activity around me, some people watching. You know, we are always making notes on our phones, comedians, with ideas of topics or things to talk about, or, you know, little trigger words of like things that happened from childhood, or like stories from, you know, college or whatever, until something kind of sparks something else. And then that branches out into hopefully another page of free writing. And then you try it on stage, and about 30% of it, best case scenario, makes it into some sort of special.
And then are you tape recording the sets, and then you go back and you rewrite from there? So you allude to this in the joke, but you lost your virginity while being a comedian, right?
Like,
and so what is the process of then realizing and accepting that, oh, there's material in this?
Well, I mean, the whole joke is that I had waited for a long time because I was a, you know, good Christian gal. And when I finally got to a place where I was like, I'm ready to have sex and I'm going to do it, and I choose you. And the guy was like too nervous to take it. Very nice guy. Very happy I dated him. Lovely, lovely man. But he just like, I think he was just too nervous because it was such a big deal. And just like couldn't go through with it, and kept kind of putting it off. And I was like, this is hilarious that you have waited so long. You're like the last one of all your friends, and not only are you failing at being a clean virginal Christian, you can't even seal the deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's that, you know, that societal, whatever gender thing of it's so unfair and whatever, but it's the thing they tell you is like, oh, you're a girl, you can sleep with whoever, and it's like, no, you can't, as it turns out. Sometimes, and I've talked to women after shows who are like, the same thing happened to me. I tried and he said no, or he wasn't into it. And that's made me feel so much better. I mean, so many jokes that I've written and done on the road really I thought were just funny, and it turns out it was like a little therapeutic for me, because other people come up and make you feel way less weird. You're like, I'm the only person that this has ever happened to that couldn't get someone to take my virginity. And there's so many people who are like, oh, same thing. It's so embarrassing.
Did you try to write material about it immediately, or is it a thing that took a few years? Like, what brought it back up to be like, now it's a thing that I'm going to talk about on stage?
I think I started talking about it after he and I broke up. But while we were dating, I was like, I'm going to get it, or you're going to get it. You're going to take it. Once we broke up, I was kind of like, that is hilarious that happened the way it did.
You alluded to it where people said they related to it, but what's interesting about watching you is partly because where most comedians in their early 20s are starting comedy, you are at this point already a somewhat experienced comedian. So you're getting to watch a person talking about being in their 20s while being in their 20s, opposed to a comedian in their 30s being like, oh, when I was in my 20s, blah, blah, blah. Can you see the difference from what you're doing to a comedian who's doing it from the perspective of someone who's like past that point in their life?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think the most common perspective is people talking about seeing people in their 20s and going like, hey, fuck you, man. Like, this, your metabolism's really fast and you aren't paying all your bills yet, and you don't know that life's gonna hit you in the face yet. Like, all those perspectives I've heard. Mm-hmm. And as someone in their 20s, I felt like, no, I know that I suck, and I know what's coming, and I know that I'm not a fully formed human yet. And so everything you guys are saying, I agree with, and I still have to be here. Do you know what I mean? Like, how everybody looks back on their 20s, like, oh, I was so dumb. I would not go back for anything. I didn't know what was happening. I'm like, imagine knowing all of that, but you're in it.
Yeah.
It's like realizing you're dreaming during a nightmare and not being able to wake yourself up, which is the only type of lucid dreaming I've done, by the way. It's terrifying because I'm working so hard on myself, been in so much therapy, and I still just do not feel like I've got it down. I don't feel like my decisions are the right ones a lot of the time. I don't feel like I know what I'm supposed to be doing. I don't even feel like I know what I want year to year. And as soon as I feel like I do know, life hits me in the face. So it really does feel like a waiting game where you're kind of like, okay, I mean, everyone keeps telling me 30s are better. So I've had so many people tell me when they turned 30, it was like a light bulb turned on and they were just them completely. Or I turned 40 and everything was great. And nobody ever says, when I turned 25, things really came together for me.
So the section of the special comes after a section where you talk about dating bad dudes and about how you specifically have a high sex drive and you sort of go into it. But you set up this section broadly as like, I know that makes me sound cooler than I am. I'm not that cool. How did you sort of land on that framing?
It wasn't even only that I wasn't fun. It was like I didn't even have any interest in partying. I was too scared to drink or do drugs or anything. Like, I mean, my mom died when I was really young, and she was pretty young, and not from drugs or anything, but I think when that happens, you kind of go, all right, I'm not going to push it, because I know bad things can happen when you're young too. So I think I missed that bubble of invincibility that a lot of young people have, particularly in college, when people look back and they go, oh man, I took so many risks. I was so dumb. I almost died 3 times. I don't have any of those stories, because I'm waking up every day like, is today the day? Yeah. Is today the day? That was not my college experience. I was already doing stand-up. Stand-up's the most irresponsible thing I've ever done, to be honest. Like, it's crazy.
But you did it in the most truly responsible way of, like, immediately as a job for Christians.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was able to go full-time, I think when I was 20, like it was fairly early, and it was more so doing colleges than churches that allowed me to do that. And you're right. I was pretty responsible even in how I went about doing stand up. I remember thinking, what can I write about that other people aren't talking about? And I thought, what do I see everyone talking about in their 20s, or like when they make a show about being in your 20s? Like, for example, like I loved Girls. I thought Girls was amazing. Did I relate to a lot of it? No, those were not my experiences. I've never bathed with a friend of mine. Like I've never danced in, you know, with my roommate. Like even those things, and those are like the tamest things. Like I didn't have any STDs. Like I had never lost my job, like, which are all very relatable things. But for me personally, I was like, I've never gone to a rave in Brooklyn. Like, this is just not what I have. So I was like, okay, I know there's more to mine there as far as just like representing the people who are going, I don't want to get fucked up and go crazy. And I don't feel this peer pressure to experience certain things. I'm just trying to keep it together. And I think a lot of people in their 20s right now are trying to do everything. I think a lot of people are trying to have that partying phase because you feel like you're supposed to, or you actually just really want to. And then there is also the side of you that's like, I got to be in the office tomorrow morning because if I don't kill it as this high-powered career person's assistant, I'll never be a high-powered career person. So I think there's never been a more stressful time to be in your 20s and have so much expected of you at once.
So you start this section with a joke. I grew up very religious, so I was encouraged to abstain from drugs and alcohol and sex and enjoyment, which you used in your 2017 Conan to set up a different abstinence joke.
Uh-huh.
Some of the jokes you told in 2017 were only told there, like the one about how it was hard because if someone else missed their period, they were pregnant, but if you did, you were carrying the Messiah.
Uh-huh.
So that joke stayed there. Were others made into your comedy lineup set? Like the joke about how you're a wild animal, I believe, is in your comedy lineup set. Can you walk me through how your sets evolve, how you thought about including which jokes where, how you decided when to drop what part of that sort of, I imagine, just font of abstinence-related material?
There is a lot in the special. You know, I probably could have put that joke in the special. I think I decided not to because that was a pretty old joke. I mean, I wrote that joke when I was a teenager. I wrote that when I was doing church. I think I wrote it when I was like 17. So when I did it on Conan, I think even that was bringing it back after a while, where I just gone, oh, this was a good joke. Why did I stop doing this? And so when it got to be on Conan, that sort of felt like, great, now that lives somewhere. And especially with social media, now you can cut up clips and put them on your Instagram and Twitter and whatnot. But then other jokes were newer, and I still liked telling them, and they fit in with chunks in the special and even newer jokes that I was doing. And then there's a lot of it that didn't make it in because, you know, whatever reason that they would have been in, but I broke up with that guy, or you know, just didn't feel like it was fitting anymore with what I had. Because if you're gonna do jokes about your ex-boyfriends, I mean, you got to limit the amount because it'll get confusing at a certain point. If
it's
you're
like,
going,
wait, which ex-boyfriend?
Yeah,
is
you're going. So my ex. This is a different one. This is another one. like it gets to be too much. So,
so I want to go step by step. Through the joke and talk about how it evolved, how did you decide to write it, what do you like about that part. So so one of the first jokes is they used to tell us the safest sex is no sex, which is a lot like saying the safest travel is books. Did this evolve? Why books instead of the safest travel is staying home or magazines? You know, like why that phrasing?
I just thought it was funny. I think it's hilarious. Like, because there are all those quotes in like every bookstore that's like, a book can take you anywhere. You can go around the world in 80 days and here's the book. I just thought that was funny and quick. And, you know, so much shorter than saying, like, that's like saying the safest travel is home. It just doesn't have the same
hard K sound.
That's just, we find hilarious. I just thought it was funny. And I also just read a bunch as a kid. And so I think when I was a kid, it really did make me feel like transported. So it's me making fun of that saying, but also buying into it a little bit, I guess.
So the next section, which is about how you didn't have sex in high school, but you did other stuff, and that was the best part. I've heard you talk about that sort of anecdotally on mm-hmm. podcasts. How did that evolve as something that would then be in your act and then be joke appropriate opposed to like whatever the longer version of just talking about it is?
So I wrote that joke because I was in relationships, and when I hadn't had sex yet, I was still sexually active by many people's standards, including the church. Was not winning many points with God with the loopholes. And I remember talking to friends of mine who were having a lot of sex and finding out that they were not like finishing, that mm-hmm. they were not getting theirs. And I was genuinely like, I cannot believe that that is the case. Like, how is that possible? That I'm like, that's so funny that every time I hook up with somebody, I'm like, no, this needs to be amazing for me because I might be giving up heaven for you. Mm-hmm. Like, it was such a different approach to it. And all I really do think it was because I grew up religious. I think I didn't want to do anything sexually unless it was going to be a great time. Like, it had to be worth disappointing my parents that much.
So the Capri Sun joke.
Oh my gosh, the Capri Sun joke. Honestly, the dude I lost my virginity to gave me that tag, and I am so angry every time I tell it. I'm like, damn it, that is good. Yeah, I was running jokes, but I was running that joke by him, and he riffed that, and it was very funny, and it made it in.
Was he a comedian? Or
yeah, he was a comedian. Mm-hmm. There are other jokes about him in the special, too.
So the joke, what happened was I was waiting until marriage or until Jesus came back, because my dad will like him, right? So this is a joke in the setup. Did you start with, you were just writing a sentence and you had the spark of it? Or did you start with the idea that my dad would approve if I was dating?
That I riffed on stage, just on the road, because that's what happened. You run these bits over and over so many times that at a certain point, your brain just starts looking for new things to keep it engaged so you don't go on autopilot, probably. And I just remember one night I just riffed that instead of saying, so I had waited, and then finally, and one night I just said, so I had waited, because I was waiting until marriage or until Jesus came back, like my dad would like him, right? Like, and it worked, so I was like, well, we're keeping that. That's very funny to me.
So the joke moves to a part about rejection that's largely about how differently boys and girls are raised and sort of like two mini act outs. How did you land on getting this point across that way, where you show the two different ways in which we talk to little kids?
The act outs?
Yeah.
I think that was probably something that came together on the road, too, where you start with this idea and it's much... Everything I have starts much shorter.
Yeah.
And then once you run it enough times where you're like, okay, this is a guaranteed laugh, you feel confident enough to start tagging it up like crazy. And you just tag it and tag it and tag it until it starts to peter out. And you go, okay, I guess that's all the tags that can handle or that's going to allow.
So it'd be like, you had a joke. It's like, oh, girls are raised and they say this and boys are like this. And then... you were like, oh, you get some laugh at that. Then so one time you'll say more things about the girls when you see it and how far mm-hmm. it goes. And same thing with the boy.
Yeah. I mean, the joke was just that growing up, everyone told me it was going to be easy and that women don't expect anyone to say no to them. And it's because of how society raises mm-hmm. us. It's what everyone's telling you. And that is all anybody told me was that you have to hold on to your virginity. You have to hold on to it. It was like everyone's always trying to take it from you. And then the minute I tried to give it to someone, they were like, I'm good, actually. I'm fine. Like,
yeah.
Which was so insane to me. And I felt lied to.
Yeah.
And whereas, you know, guys are kind of like prepped to hear no. Like they're kind of like, especially now, it's like, hey, like if someone's uncomfortable, you need to stop mm-hmm. because in a lot of cases you might be stronger than them or whatever, their boss, and you can't do that. So I thought that was just funny and also kind of sad.
So the line, you're going to need to get consent, which is a noise she makes, not a feeling you feel.
That was a riff too on the road. Yeah.
I truly was like, well, you didn't riff that.
Oh, I did on the road, yeah, because it was, if there's an act out, I usually riffed a good portion of it, but I started with the act out. And if you're, if you get, once you get that rolling laugh and you feel like you can just keep going, that's the stuff I go back to listen to, especially because mm-hmm. that's the stuff I won't remember a lot of the time. And yeah, I just thought that was funny because you hear so many, there are so many, you know, articles and stories and stuff about dates or sexual encounters where you really go like, okay, that wasn't cool, but I also really think that dude just didn't realize,
yeah.
like really didn't know, like thought everything was cool. And I think the fact that now we're all as a society, as a culture, like moving into a place of like, no, you need to just ask and be communicative and figure it out is so good. So it prevents that miscommunication.
In the comedy lineup set, you have a joke about sort of women's fears of being sexually assaulted mm-hmm. and where you tell the men in the audience who are tightening up, the joke isn't for them.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, in general, this is probably the most pointed part of the joke, though a lot of this joke, sort of the subtext, is the benefit of actually communicating mm-hmm. with your sexual partner. How do you think about this stuff in terms of being more direct and being more pointed and being like, listen, this, I'm telling you something. I want the audience to leave here with some amount of information about like how they should behave.
I don't ever write anything going, people need to hear this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like I never go into it that way. I just kind of write about what I think is funny and interesting. And if those moments pop up and they feel appropriate, then I'll lean into them. Because I think as a comedian, you're just always trying to address what's happening in the room. And so every time I did that joke, I absolutely felt like guys were kind of like, I don't think about that or I don't get it. And it starts off with like, ladies, like, you know, so you do feel like you almost have to say something to guys in the room to bring them back in
mm-hmm.
so they don't sort of check out.
Yeah.
And again, not their fault. I mean, you guys don't worry about getting murdered that much. And I love that for you. That's amazing. which is, I do another bit about it in my new hour about how I think it's so funny that like my boyfriend is more afraid of me being mad at him than dead. Like, he will check in with me if he thinks I'm angry, but he won't check in if he just doesn't hear from me for 4 hours. He's just like, well, I'm just probably pooping or something. like I know a lot of people who have fights about that in their heterosexual relationship where they're like, hey, he's never worried about me and I'm always worried about him or whatever. And I've had so many talks with guys I've dated about that. Again, just one of those things where it makes me feel way less alone to yeah. have people say that they know what I'm talking about. But yeah, I'm never going out of my way to deliver a message.
Yeah, yeah. So we move to the sort of what I wrote down as the triad of similes. So you have a lot of similes, but this is sort of like simile, which is you have the Gap one, then the mm-hmm. Costco one, and then the Las Vegas nightclub flyers.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember writing that piece? How did you sort of attack that section?
The Gap joke I added literally like 2 weeks before I filmed the special. That's the one about I felt like I was trying to get hired. Yeah. Because it really did feel that way. The Costco line was something people had actually said to me. Like when I was younger, I remember people saying that of like, oh, it's easy. It's just like handy. Like, which was what I thought of when I got rejected sexually. I was like, are you kidding me? This is what I've been told. And then the nightclub fires, a specific thing that I wrote. Yeah, that was the first thing I wrote because I was trying to think of, I tried a few different versions of that. I remember when I wrote it early on where I think the initial version of the joke I had tried to say like, it was more on like your virginity's a gift. And it mm-hmm. was like, I tried to give him my gift and he was just like, is there a gift receipt? Like it was a different thing. And I think I might have done shows in Vegas
yeah.
and I just saw those guys and I'm like, oh, nobody wants to take that from them. And they're trying so hard and that's the perfect visual.
So then the joke about, but you know what they say, women always go for men like their father. So I keep going for guys who don't want to sleep with me.
Yeah.
And then you explain to people that joke is nice and that joke
yeah.
is about how your dad's good. It's an interesting moment. The audience truly does not know where.
Yeah.
How did that feel to be in that?
Well, here's the thing. I have done it so many times. It's every night. There's never a night where it just murders and everyone carries me out on their shoulders. Like, there is always some weirdness, and it's because all people hear is incest. That's mm-hmm. all they hear. And you're like, that's the opposite of what I'm saying. And I thought the joke was so good and funny. And I'm like, this is an airtight joke. I think the first version of the joke I wrote was like, they say women go for men like their fathers, which is why I like guys who would think, who feel weird about kissing me, like something like that. Mm. And
that is almost too true.
Yeah. I think this joke is good. And I think people laugh at it and think it's funny, but they do tense up, especially if you're there with your parents. Sometimes people go to comedy shows with their parents. I could see why you might be uncomfortable with it, but I did just start calling it out because it's sort of a save line, but it's also like, you think about it for a second.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't just like knee-jerk reaction and go, ooh, you want to sleep with your dad? No, that's the opposite of the joke. The joke is, my dad is my dad, so of course he wouldn't want to. And it's funny that I am trying to date men who also just aren't interested in me in that way.
I imagine if you took a very long pause, they would think about it and be like, oh, but because you immediately know they are going to not get it. You are essentially calling on their brain, figuring it out.
Yeah. Well, and I'm not that patient, too. Yeah. And my style is just very fast, so I'm not going to wait that long. I'm not one of these people who has the patience to be like, let's just sit in this for a minute until you guys come round. Yeah. Like, I'm like, no, if you're not at my pace, I will steamroll you.
So you finally get to sort of what is the premise of the joke about how you lost your virginity late, which you set it up. Which, in a more classic style joke, you'd be like, I lost my virginity late. And the audience would go, like, how late did you lose it? But can you walk me through how it evolves to financial independence and sort of what are an example of financial independence? Which ends with the IKEA painting that I purchased with a coupon.
True. Although I don't know that I had a coupon. I think I wrote this pretty quickly after I lost my virginity. Like, maybe like the next day I started running it, where I'm like, it's so funny that it took me this long and that I did try before this and it didn't pan out. Yeah, I remember thinking it's so funny that most of my friends lost it when they were still on their parents', you know, cell phone plan and everything. Or a lot of them lost it, you know, when we were in high school or when they were in college in like a dorm room or something. Like, their parents were heavily financially involved in their lives and they are having sex. And I'm like, that's insane. I mean, I definitely waited until I was out of my parents' house to try to lose my virginity because that felt respectful. And I'm like, I was living in LA, like I was doing pretty well and I couldn't lose my virginity. But I mean, I only live with one roommate, and I have a bathroom in my room. So, I mean, something's going right, I guess.
Yeah. So, the last section is really interesting. It's the same time sort of the most personal, and there's a part that's sort of like offering the audience a bit of a take-home message, and then it builds to obviously this big applause break punchline. Can you walk me through the evolution of that last part?
So, the closer that you referred to earlier on the comedy lineup that I had used about the guys weren't not wanting to wear condoms, that had been about a guy I dated before and was like one of my favorite jokes to do. And once I did it on Netflix, I was like, well, I can't do this anymore. And after that, I was like, oh man, I'm gonna need like a new closer, and this is, we gotta think of something. And I was in a new relationship and we'd been seeing each other for like a few weeks. And I remember it was like getting to that point. I was like at his apartment or something. And I was like, I'm not really there yet. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was such a non-issue. And he was just like, okay, yeah, it's fine. And we just like watched a movie or something and he was totally cool about it. And I remember going, oh my gosh, that I think I'm good now. Like that, maybe that's what I needed. And I started thinking about all my relationships and going, have I always done that? And is that a safety thing? Is that a, you know, growing up abstinent kind of thing where I need somebody to say it's okay, we don't have to have sex, so I know they respect me? Because that's the whole pitch, is that if someone has sex with you before marriage, they don't respect you, and yada, yada, yada.
Did you write this joke, like, right afterwards?
Yeah,
like
pretty
close. Next week, you're like, what just happened? Let me write a joke that explains it to myself.
Yeah.
Do you remember coming up with the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory ending?
I mean, I just loved that movie growing up. So I think it came to me fairly easily. I might have sat down and tried to think of examples. Sometimes I will do that where I go, I know there's something here and I know there's something to compare it to. And I remember when I started doing the joke, there wasn't that whole like, there wasn't like this twirling the cane yeah. act out. And a very funny comic, Matt Broussard, like gave me a tag. He said, you should say like, welcome to my chocolate factory. And then I changed it to come inside my chocolate factory. And the next time he saw it, he was like, oh my gosh, that's so much dirtier than what I pitched you. And I was like, hey, it works. Thank you, man. Yeah. So yeah, it started with, Charlie, it's all for you. And then it just, again, you start mm-hmm. tagging it until it becomes much longer and turns into something that you can close on.
Do you remember, the first time you did it or the first time you did it where you're like, this really, really worked?
I know the first couple times I did it, I said on stage, like, I'm so glad that worked because I love it so much and I wasn't sure if it would work. I did do it at a couple colleges and realized they did not watch that movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you saw like the remake with Johnny Depp, it's not the same thing,
yeah, yeah.
I don't think.
Don't care.
And you don't care because it's not a good movie. But the Gene Wilder one is such a classic. Mm. And that scene is so kind of like manipulative and fucked up, but also magical.
Yeah.
And which is kind of what sex is. And I just like, once I came up with the comparison, I was like, if this works, it will be my favorite joke to do.
We'll be right back with more Taylor Tomlinson.
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special three-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prop G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
Calling all female runners, it's time to lace up and join Team Milk. Since the 2022 New York City Marathon, Team Milk has sponsored female marathon runners nationwide, providing support and shining a spotlight on their unique stories, perseverance, and drive to go the distance. Why milk? Dairy Milk is an excellent nutritional ad for both marathon training and recovery. Milk contains 13 essential nutrients, including high-quality protein, making it a crucial component of a training diet. Plus, it's one of the best beverages for hydration, even better than water. The same electrolytes that are added to many of your favorite sports drinks are found naturally in milk. And in 2024, Team Milk is taking the next step to empower female runners by launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. Built to be accessible, empowering, and community building, the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
And we're back with Taylor Tomlinson. So I think anyone who hears this will be struck by just sort of how many freaking jokes there are in it. Like, there's just like, there are punchlines in the premises, there's punchlines in the setups. Do you have rules of thumb of how often you want a laugh? How do you think about pacing?
Oh, as often as I can get one. I need lots of validation every 10 to 15 seconds. Usually when I write a new bit, if there are gaps or the setup's too long, or if there's too long a stretch without a laugh, I start to get nervous and itchy. Mm-hmm. So I'm always trying to have as many punchlines as possible. In the same way, like when you're doing a late night set, you just want to cram in as much as possible. I feel the same way about an hour.
So I have some thoughts about this, and this might be a pretty sharp transition for the listener. And thus, so I want to talk a little bit about how you lost your mother when you were 8.
Oh, yeah.
Because I lost my mother around the same time.
Oh,
wow.
I was
almost about to turn 8. And I would hear you talk in interviews. And I was like, oh, we had very similar experiences.
Really?
Yeah. When I see a comedian who is sort of a machine gun like you are, I think I learned this talking to Whitney Cummings. There feels like there's like these complimentary impulses of a desire for control of the audience that comes with like, I'm going to make them laugh and I know where it's going to be. And as you sort of hint in the special, a difficulty trusting people, a difficulty trusting the audience, mm-hmm. that if I'm not making them laugh, that they're going to still like me. Mm. Does that resonate with you?
So much. Oh my gosh. Ouch.
Well, I don't mean it to hurt your feelings. I hope.
No, I mean, ouch, I feel so seen. Oh. That's I'm just raw out here. Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I think the new material that I have now, I have like 15 minutes in the new hour about losing my mom. And it's, I had some of it before I filmed this special and I thought about putting it in. I think some of it was in the submission video that we gave to Netflix, and I ended up cutting it because I thought, you know what, I want this special to be sort of representative of like the first 5 years of my 20s. Like that's what it feels like a snapshot of. That's what it feels like I'm qualified to talk about. Also, I feel like there's more to losing my mom than I have currently, and I don't want to do like 5 minutes in this hour about being in your 20s and dating is crazy. It felt a little like out of nowhere. Whereas this new hour thematically is like, these are my experiences in therapy. This is my experience calling off my wedding. This is, you know, why I'm like this because I lost my mom in a lot of ways. This is kind of my relationship now. Like it's definitely dealing with all that stuff. I have jokes about how I don't trust people and how it's hard for me to trust people at the beginnings of relationships, and it all feeds into each other. It really does, because you start off by just having trust issues and then you go to therapy and they go, these are all the reasons you have those, and you go, oh my gosh, so I'm fixed now, and they go, no, now you just know why you suck, and you're like, so what do I do? And they're like, you come back next week with your credit card. I really wanted to talk about it, and I wanted to have the maturity to talk about it, and I didn't feel like I had it yet. And it's funny, once we got this special in the can, I started working out those jokes on the road, and even now, like, there are audiences that are like, they get bummed or sad. And you just build in those jokes where you call people out for it. And, you know, you got to understand, you go, the people who are tensing up probably didn't lose their parents. Like the people who are tensing up about that stuff in the same way, like when you tell somebody that you lost a parent, I'm sure you've experienced this. If they haven't lost anybody, they get really sad and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But if someone else has, in the same way you have a shorthand with like other comedians, you have like a shorthand with people with dead parents who like lost them as kids, where you're like, oh yeah, I see you. I know what that was. Like, I get it, you know?
Do you feel like as you've gotten better at a comedian, you've gotten better at just trusting the audience to listen to you and trusting the audience to deserve that part of yourself?
I think I trust myself more. Mm-hmm. I think when I was younger, I was nervous because I felt a need to make everyone comfortable in the audience because I knew I was young. I knew I looked young. And I knew that when I got on stage, everybody was kind of like, okay, I hope this doesn't go badly. Yeah. And I could feel it. And so pretty early on, I was like, okay, I need to know how to move confidently, how to speak confidently, how to move the mic stand confidently. Like it felt like setting myself up was very important. And I think also, hopefully enough people watch this special that there's more of a familiarity with me when people come out to see me. Mm-hmm. Because now people do come out to see me, but there's still a good chunk of the audience who doesn't know who I am and just wants to see comedy that weekend or just watch like one Tonight Show set of mine. And I think once people get to know you, you have a little bit more freedom to explore more personal things or take more chances because people are already fans and already understand and know your voice, so they don't have to get used to it for the first 10 minutes. So that's sort of what I was waiting for, and I'm glad I waited for it because it definitely felt like the right decision. And I feel like I find new things about it all the time because I'm sure you feel the same way as like, when you lose a parent that young, you don't process it at that age fully because you don't know what's happening.
Yeah. I always think about people like, oh, comedians are the funniest people. It's like, well, they have a proclivity to be funny, but also they needed to keep on doing it. It's so weird to be a comedian, and it's so hard to get through the first however many years that there has to be a reason why laughter matters to them so much.
Yeah.
Is that the case with you?
Absolutely. That's what I tell people when they say, what advice do you have for me who's starting out or doing comedy? I go, it truly, and I know other people have said this, like, if you can do something else, go do that other thing. Like, if you don't need to do this, I've been friends with people where I've basically said, like, I don't think you need to do it. And I'm like, the road's not fun. You're not going to like the road. You're going to like doing stand up, but you have to need it so badly that you're willing to put up with everything else you have to put up with until you become successful. And it is going to take as long as it's going to take. I mean, I've gotten very lucky. I know people who had to wait a lot longer for a special like that. Like, it's, you just never know how it's going to go down. You just have to keep working really hard every day. And if you don't love the process in an obsessive, unhealthy way, and you don't need the validation from strangers, you know, you'll probably tap out.
Have you ever seen or heard Hamilton, the musical Hamilton?
Yes, both.
Great. So this is a lot easier of a question.
Oh my gosh, so good. Is it the overwhelm them with honesty quote?
It's the write like you're running out of time.
Love it. Love it.
Do you feel that way?
Yes, absolutely. My mom passed away when she was 34. How old was
I think about 39, 40, I think.
Wow, okay. So do you, growing up...
Think I'm going to die at that age? Yeah.
Okay, yes. It's super common, apparently, and I didn't know that. And I don't even think I realized I had that fear until a few years ago. And I think, in addition to, I have to be really good if I'm going to disappoint my parents, I also have that in the back of my head, which is, okay, I may only have till 34, because in addition, my mom's aunt also died, same cancer, 34. So there's a pattern, rule of threes. And I do feel like on a certain level, every time I get something, there's this morbid part of my brain that goes, you know, the universe is giving you this because you don't have that much time left, which is so dark and so sad, but it really is.
So it's less of a, oh, it's interesting, because I think coming from a religious background, you think the universe is giving you this instead of like, I'm creating this because I only have so much time and I need something.
Yeah, but it's both. I mean, yeah, the reason I didn't party and the reason I work hard are the same thing, is I don't have that much time. I don't have time to be irresponsible like you guys do because I don't have till I'm 70. And even if I do, I may not. Like, that's the thing. You don't know that you're going to die at that age, but you're like, I have a hunch. And also, even days that you're more positive and you're like, I'll live later than that, you know you're going to feel so bad when you live past that age. That's another thing I've heard from people, is that they have like this survivor's guilt.
This is the last question about this stuff.
No, I love it. It's great.
So there's this book, The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. Have you heard of this book?
No, is it good?
Yeah, it's really good.
Okay, I gotta read it. Are you terrified of death all the time?
Yeah, all the time.
Okay, me too.
So it never ends.
Yeah, and it like hits you like when you're happy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where you're like, okay, anytime now.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I feel so seen.
Yeah, so it's you know, it's broadly about how all human behavior is in the denial of death or man's attempt to create immortality.
Yeah.
And there's a part I think about a lot with this job where I talk to creative people and artists, in which the author talks about Otto Rank, who was a psychologist who was a mentee of Freud and worked with a lot of artists. So essentially, this section is about how Rank said the religion is the easiest way to live knowing we die. It's simpler. It's sort of like, oh, if you believe in it, then you don't really have to ask any more questions.
Mm-hmm.
But if not, otherwise, he writes, only the creative type can affirm and accept himself for himself to some extent, he reasoned, by using his work as a justification for existence, essentially saying because artists can create their own meaning, they're sort of the only other option if you're not going to be religious.
Mm.
As a person who had these two things, who is a creative person who became aware of death at an early age and who was raised religious, does that resonate with you? Do you feel power in having the ability to sort of create your own meaning?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's that idea of leaving work behind. That's a sort of immortality as well, where you go, okay, I'm going to leave behind these specials, or like, that's why creative people love watching Hamilton, because you go, oh, man, that was so many years ago and we're still, now we're watching, there's just all these books about him, he's in textbooks and there's statues, and now there's a rap musical about him. Like, I'm never going to die if I write something this good, like, because it just keeps your memory alive, and you feel like you can keep affecting people even when you're gone. And maybe on some level that tricks our brains into thinking we'll still be here. Mm.
So I've heard you talk about this idea that has been said by a few people, but probably most popularly in a viral clip starring Ira Glass, in which he says, when you start out, your taste is sort of superior than your ability. You know how good you want to be with your art, but you don't know necessarily how to do it yet. So what does the comedian you imagine being look like when your ability meets your aspiration?
Ooh. I don't know. Hopefully that I'll be able to write really hard-hitting, punchy jokes about very personal things. I think that's where I would like to get to. I would like to be able to tell jokes about anything I want to, no matter how personal and specific, and make it feel relatable and accessible to whoever's watching it. I mean, obviously, there's always going to be somebody who doesn't like what you're doing, but for the most part, I would like to be able to exploit the darkest things that have happened to me for this medium.
So that sound means it's time for our final segment, which is the laughing round. It's like a lightning round, but because it's comedy, it's a laughing round.
Oh, I know what it is. Oh. Big fan.
Oh, no. Usually I have to surprise people with that term.
They're like, what's that graphic? I'm like, here it is.
Do you have a joke you wish you could steal in so much as it's another dimension where everything's exactly the same, but you have this person's joke. No one is none the wiser. Your life is exactly the same, but you have this joke in your act.
I don't know if I have a specific joke in mind that I would steal. I mean, there's so many jokes I like think are amazing. If I could just be Maria Bamford in an alternate universe, that would be amazing. Because I am nothing like her, and she's my absolute favorite. I think she's so brilliant. People have asked me who my favorite comedian is so many times in the last few weeks, and
I've
said her so many times. I'm like starting to feel creepy.
What would your young adult book be about?
Ooh, probably something like fantasy or supernatural driven. Like, if I hadn't found comedy, I would probably be like some embarrassing, like Stephanie Meyer's type writer, where I'm just trying to, you know, write escapist love stories involving ghosts or something for 13-year-olds. Because I hated being in middle school so much, and like the only thing I liked doing was like reading Harry Potter. So I would be trying to write wizard school books, probably.
So your special is going to come up when people search for Taylor Swift's documentary.
Yes!
So what is your appeal to her fans to watch your special?
You guys, I mean, I'm just as petty. All of my jokes about my ex-boyfriends, I mean, you should see my set list. It looks like a Taylor Swift album. Each one is just a different man's name. That's my appeal to it. Someone told me that they're like, people who like Taylor Swift will probably like your special. And I was like, I will take it.
Last, do you have a joke that has never worked, you've tried it over and over again, you think it's really funny, but at this point, audiences have told you you can't do it anymore, but you will be like, you guys were wrong, this was right.
There is a joke that I tried a few times that did like very well. You know when you do a joke that does great on like Twitter, but you do it on stage and it doesn't work? I tried a joke that I had done on Twitter, and it just, audiences did not like it. I tried it maybe two or three times. Where I said, I refer to all the ex-boyfriends I've had as a human centipede because I always hold the next one accountable for the previous one's shit.
It's good.
It is good, but it's not what anyone wants to hear about. Nobody likes human centipede references. It's like a gross image, but it's comparing it to something emotional, so I'm like, this is fine, right? And I don't think people can get past the human centipede thing.
Let's end with this. So we've talked about the artist's way a few times. What is a dream artist date that you have or would like to have taking yourself on?
Ooh, take myself on an artist date. I would like to go to some sort of spa retreat in nature and wake up and be able to eat very healthy food and take some sort of hot spring bath outside and then just sit in nature and write, whether it be jokes or morning pages, and wake up, you know, really early and see the sunrise and feel the misty dew on my face, and then, you know, have a nap in the afternoon so I can sit outside and watch the stars at night. I think just anywhere that I felt like I was in nature and I could hide from a lot of people and responsibilities. Sounds amazing.
That's it for another episode. You can stream Quarter Life Crisis on Netflix. Follow Taylor on social media at Taylor Tomlinson. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, and Art Chung. Editorial assistance from Amanda Gordon and Emily Sen. Gautam Srikishan did our theme song. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars, please. Email any comments, questions, or laughing round suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet us at goodonepodcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me at Jesse David Fox. Good One is a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. We'll be back next week with Mark Maron. Have a good one.
What does it take to be an entrepreneur, and how is it changing in our ever-evolving business landscape? This is Scott Galloway, host of the Prop G Podcast and an entrepreneur myself. Right now, we've got a special 3-part series running all about the future of entrepreneurship. We're answering your questions on work-life balance, how to raise capital for your business, and more. Because when you're an entrepreneur, it's always important to look ahead at what's to come. So tune in to the Future of Entrepreneurship, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Mercury. You can find it on the Prop G Pod feed or wherever you get your podcasts.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.